Like most humanoids, I am burdened with what the Buddhists call the monkey mind, the thoughts that swing from limb to limb, stopping only to scratch themselves, spit, and howl. From the distant past to the unknowable future, my mind swings wildly through time, touching on dozens of ideas a minute, unharnessed and undisciplined. This in itself is not necessarily a problem. The problem is the emotional attachment that goes along with the thinking. Happy thoughts make me happy, but whoop, how quickly I swing again into obsessive worry, blowing the mood, and then it's the remembrance of an angry moment, and I start to get hot and pissed off all over again, and then my mind decides it might be a good time to start feeling sorry for itself, and loneliness promptly follows. You are, after all, what you think. Your emotions are the slaves to your thoughts, and you are the slave to your emotions. The other problem with all this swinging through the vines of thought is that you are never where you are. You are always digging in the past or poking at the future, but rarely do you rest in this moment. It's something like the habit of my dear friend Susan, who, whenever she sees a beautiful place, exclaims in near panic, "It's so beautiful here! I want to come back here someday!" And it takes all of my persuasive powers to try to convince her that she is already here. If you're looking for union with the divine, this kind of forward-backward whirling is a problem. There's a reason they call God a presence, because God is right here, right now. In the present is the only place to find him, and now is the only time. But to stay in the present moment requires dedicated, one-pointed focus. Different meditation techniques teach one-pointedness in different ways. For instance, by focusing your eyes on a single point of light, or by observing the rise and fall of your breath. My guru teaches meditation with the help of a mantra, sacred words or syllables to be repeated in a focused manner. Mantra has a dual function. For one thing, it gives the mind something to do. It's as if you've given the monkey a pile of 10,000 buttons and said, "Move these buttons, one at a time, into a new pile." This is a considerably easier task for the monkey than if you just plopped him in a corner and asked him not to move. The other purpose of mantra is to transport you to another state, rowboat-like, through the choppy waves of the mind. Whenever your attention gets pulled into a cross-current of thought, just return to the mantra, climb back into the boat, and keep going. The great Sanskrit mantras are said to contain unimaginable powers, the ability to row you, if you can stay with one, all the way to the shorelines of divinity. Among my many, many problems with meditation is that the mantra I have been given, Om Namah Shivaya, doesn't sit comfortably in my head. I love the sound of it and I love the meaning of it, but it does not glide me into meditation. It never has, not in the 2 years I've been practicing this yoga. When I try to repeat Om Namah Shivaya in my head, it actually gets stuck in my throat, making my chest clench tightly, making me nervous. I can never match the syllables to my breathing. I end up asking my roommate, Corella, about this one night. I'm shy to admit to her how much trouble I have keeping my mind focused on mantra repetition, but she is a meditation teacher. Maybe she can help me. She tells me that her mind used to wander during meditation too, but that now her practice is the great, easy, transformative joy of her life. "Seems I just sit down and shut my eyes," she says, "and all I have to do is think the mantra and I vanish right into heaven." Hearing this, I am struck nauseous with envy. Then again, Corella has been practicing yoga for almost as many years as I've been alive. I ask her if she can show me exactly how she uses Om Namah Shivaya in her meditation practice. Does she take one inhale for every syllable? When I do this, it feels really interminable and annoying. Or is it one word for every breath? But the words are all different lengths, so how do you even it out? Or does she just say the whole mantra once on the inhale, then once again on the exhale? Because when I try to do that, it gets all speeded up and I get anxious. "I don't know," Corella says. "I just kind of say it." "But do you sing it?" I push, desperate now. "Do you put a beat on it?" "I just say it." "Could you maybe speak aloud for me the way you say it in your head while you're meditating?" Indulgently, my roommate closes her eyes and starts saying the mantra aloud, the way it appears in her head. And, indeed, she's just saying it. She says it quietly, normally, smiling slightly. She says it a few times, in fact, until I get restless and cut her off. "But don't you get bored?" I ask. "Ah," says Corella, and opens her eyes, smiling. She looks at her watch. 10 seconds have passed, Liz. bored already, are we? 42. The following morning, I arrive right on time for the 4 a.m. meditation session, which always starts the day here. We are meant to sit for an hour in silence, but I log the minutes as if they are miles, 60 brutal miles that I have to endure. By mile 14, my nerves have started to go, my knees are breaking down, and I'm overcome with exasperation, which is understandable, given that the conversations between me and my mind during meditation generally go something like this. Okay, we're going to meditate now. Let's draw our attention to our breath and focus on the mantra. Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah. I can help you out with this, you know. Okay, good, because I need your help. So let's go. Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah. I can help you think of nice meditative images. Like, hey, here's a good one. Imagine you're a temple on an island, and the island is in the ocean. Oh, that is a nice image. Thanks. I thought of it myself. But what ocean are we picturing here? The Mediterranean. Imagine you're one of those Greek islands with an old Greek temple on it. No, never mind. That's too touristy. You know what? Forget the ocean. Oceans are too dangerous. Here's a better idea. Imagine you're on an island in a lake, okay? Okay, can we meditate now? Om Namah Shiva. Yes, definitely. But try not to picture that the lake is covered with, what are those things called? Jet skis? Yes, jet skis. Those things consume so much fuel. They're really a menace to the environment. You know what else uses a lot of fuel? Leaf blowers. You wouldn't think so, but okay. But let's meditate now, okay? Please. Om Namah. Right. I definitely want to help you meditate. And that's why we're going to skip the image of an island on an ocean or a lake, because that's obviously not working. So let's imagine that you're an island in a river. Oh, you mean like Bannerman Island in the Hudson River? Yes, exactly. Perfect. Therefore, in conclusion, let's meditate on this image. Envision that you are an island in a river. All the thoughts that float by as you're meditating, these are just the river's natural currents, and you can ignore them because you are an island. Wait, I thought you said I was a temple. That's right, sorry. You're a temple on an island. In fact, you are both the temple and the island. Am I also the river? No, the river is just the thoughts. Stop, please, stop. You're making me crazy. Sorry, I was only trying to help. Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. Here there is a promising 8-second pause in thoughts, but then, are you mad at me now? And then, with a big gasp, like I am coming up for air, my mind wins, my eyes fly open, and I quit, in tears. An ashram is supposed to be a place where you come to deepen your meditation, but this is a disaster. The pressure is too much for me, I can't do it. But what should I do? Run out of the temple crying after 14 minutes every day? This morning, though, instead of fighting it, I just stopped. I gave up. I let myself slump against the wall behind me. My back hurt. I had no strength. My mind was quivering. My posture collapsed like a bridge crumbling down. I took the mantra off the top of my head, where it had been pressing down on me like an invisible anvil, and set it on the floor beside me. And then I said to God, I'm really sorry, but this is the closest I could get to you today. The Lakota Sioux say that a child who cannot sit still is a half-developed child. And an old Sanskrit text says, by certain signs you can tell when meditation is being rightly performed. One of them is that a bird will sit on your head, thinking you are an inert thing. This has not exactly happened to me yet. But for the next 40 minutes or so, I tried to stay as quiet as possible, trapped in that meditation hall, and ensnared in my own shame and inadequacy, watching the devotees around me as they sat in their perfect postures, their perfect eyes closed, their smug faces emanating calmness as they surely transported themselves into some perfect heaven. I was full of a hot, powerful sadness, and would have loved to have burst into the comfort of tears, but tried hard not to, remembering something my guru once said, that you should never give yourself a chance to fall apart, because when you do, it becomes a tendency, and it happens over and over again. You must practice staying strong instead. But I didn't feel strong. My body ached in diminished worthlessness. I wondered, who is the me when I am conversing with my mind, and who is the mind? I thought about the relentless, thought-processing, soul-devouring machine that is my brain, and I wondered how on earth I was ever going to master it. Then I remembered that line from Jaws and couldn't help smiling. We're going to need a bigger boat. 43. Dinner time. I'm sitting alone, trying to eat slowly. My guru is always encouraging us to practice discipline when it comes to eating. She encourages us to eat in moderation and without desperate gulps, not to extinguish the sacred fires of our bodies by dumping too much food into our digestive tracts too fast. My guru, I am fairly certain, has never been to Naples. When students come to her complaining that they're having trouble meditating, she always asks how their digestion has been lately. It only stands to reason that you'll have trouble gliding lightly into transcendence when your guts are struggling to churn through a sausage calzone, a pound of buffalo wings, and a half a coconut cream pie. Which is why they don't serve that kind of stuff here. The food at the ashram is vegetarian, light, and healthy, but still delicious, which is why it's difficult for me not to wolf it down like a starving orphan. Plus, meals are served buffet-style, and it never has been easy for me to resist taking a second or third turn at bat when beautiful food is just lying out there in the open, smelling good and costing nothing. So I'm sitting there at the dinner table all by myself, making an effort to restrain my fork, when I see a man walk over with his dinner tray, looking for an open chair. I nod to him that he is welcome to join me. I haven't seen this guy around here yet. He must be a new arrival. The stranger's got a cool, ain't-no-big-hurry kind of walk, and he moves with the authority of a border town sheriff, or maybe a lifelong high-rolling poker player. He looks like he's in his 50s, but walks like he's lived a few centuries longer than that. He's got white hair, and a white beard, and a plaid flannel shirt. Wide shoulders and giant hands that look like they could do some damage, but a totally relaxed face. He sits down across from me and drawls, "Man, they got mosquitoes around this place big enough to rape a chicken." Ladies and gentlemen, Richard from Texas has arrived. 44. Among the many jobs that Richard from Texas has held in his life, and I know I'm leaving a lot of them out, are oil field worker, 18-wheeler truck driver, the first authorized dealer of Birkenstocks in the Dakotas, sack shaker in a Midwestern landfill. I'm sorry, but I really don't have time to explain what a sack shaker is. Highway construction worker, used car salesman, soldier in Vietnam, commodities broker, that commodity generally being Mexican narcotics, junkie and alcoholic, if you can call this a profession, then reformed junkie and alcoholic, a much more respectable profession, hippie farmer on a commune, radio voiceover announcer, and finally successful dealer in high-end medical equipment. Until his marriage fell apart, and he gave the whole business to his ex and got left scratching my broke white ass again. Now he renovates old houses in Austin. "Never did have much of a career path," he says. "Never could do anything but the hustle." Richard from Texas is not a guy who worries about a lot of stuff. I wouldn't call him a neurotic person, no sir. But I am a bit neurotic, and that's why I've come to adore him. Richard's presence at this ashram becomes my great and amusing sense of security. His giant, ambling confidence hushes down all my inherent nervousness and reminds me that everything really is going to be okay. And if not okay, then at least comic. Remember the cartoon rooster, Foghorn Leghorn? Well, Richard is kind of like that, and I become his chatty little sidekick, the chicken hawk. In Richard's own words, "Me and groceries, we steady be laughing the whole damn time." Groceries. That's the nickname Richard has given me. He bestowed it upon me the first night we met, when he noticed how much I could eat. I tried to defend myself. I was purposefully eating with discipline and intention, but the name stuck. Maybe Richard from Texas doesn't seem like a typical yogi, though my time in India has cautioned me against deciding what a typical yogi is. Don't get me started on the dairy farmer from rural Ireland I met here the other day, or the former nun from South Africa. Richard came to this yoga through an ex-girlfriend who drove him up from Texas to the ashram in New York to hear the guru speak. Richard says, "I thought the ashram was the weirdest thing I ever saw, and I was wondering where the room was where you had to give them all your money and turn over the deed to your house and car, but that never did happen." After that experience, which was about 10 years ago, Richard found himself praying all the time. His prayer was always the same. He kept begging God, "Please, please, please, open my heart." That was all he wanted, an open heart. And he would always finish the prayer for an open heart by asking God, "And please send me a sign when the event has occurred." Now, he says, recollecting that time, "Be careful what you pray for, groceries, 'cause you just might get it." After a few months of praying constantly for an open heart, what do you think Richard got? That's right, emergency open heart surgery. His chest was literally cracked open, his ribs cleaved away from each other to allow some daylight to finally reach into his heart, as though God were saying, "How's that for a sign?" So now Richard is always cautious with his prayers, he tells me. "Whenever I pray for anything these days, I always wrap it up by saying, 'Oh, and God, please be gentle with me, okay?'" "What should I do about my meditation practice?" I ask Richard one day, as he's watching me scrub the temple floors. He's lucky. He works in the kitchen, doesn't even have to show up there until an hour before dinner. But he likes watching me scrub the temple floors. He thinks it's funny. "Why do you have to do anything about it, groceries?" "Because it stinks." "Says who?" "I can't get my mind to sit still." "Remember what the guru teaches us. If you sit down with the pure intention to meditate, whatever happens next is none of your business. So why are you judging your experience?" "Because what's happening in my meditations cannot be the point of this yoga." "Groceries, baby, you got no idea what's happening in there." "But I never see visions. I never have transcendent experiences. You want to see pretty colors? Or you want to know the truth about yourself? What's your intention?" "All I seem to do is argue with myself when I try to meditate." "Well, that's just your ego trying to make sure it stays in charge. This is what your ego does. It keeps you feeling separate, keeps you with a sense of duality, tries to convince you that you're flawed and broken and alone instead of whole." "But how does that serve me?" "It doesn't serve you. Your ego's job isn't to serve you. Its only job is to keep itself in power. And right now your ego's scared to death because it's about to get downsized. You keep up this spiritual path, baby, and that bad boy's days are numbered. Pretty soon your ego will be out of work, and your heart will be making all the decisions. So your ego's fighting for its life, playing with your mind, trying to assert its authority, trying to keep you cornered off in a holding pen away from the rest of the universe. Don't listen to it." "But how do you not listen to it?" "Ever try to take a toy away from a toddler? They don't like that, do they? They start kicking and screaming. Best way to take a toy away from a toddler is to distract the kid, give him something else to play with, divert his attention. Instead of trying to forcefully take thoughts out of your mind, give your mind something better to play with, something healthier." "Like what?" "Like love, groceries. Like pure, divine love." 45. Going into that meditation cave every day is supposed to be this time of divine communion, but I've been walking in there lately flinching the way my dog used to flinch when she walked into the vet's office, knowing that no matter how friendly everybody might be acting now, this whole thing was going to end with a sharp poke with a medical instrument. But after my last conversation with Richard from Texas, I'm trying a new approach this morning. I sit down to meditate, and I say to my mind, "Listen, I understand you're a little frightened, but I promise I'm not trying to annihilate you. I'm just trying to give you a place to rest. I love you." The other day, a monk told me, "The resting place of the mind is the heart. The only thing the mind hears all day is clanging bells and noise and argument, and all it wants is quietude. The only place the mind will ever find peace is inside the silence of the heart. That's where you need to go." I'm trying a different mantra, too. It's one I've had luck with in the past. It's simple, just two syllables. Hum Sa. In Sanskrit, it means, "I am that." The yogis say that Hum Sa is the most natural mantra, the one we are all given by God before birth. It is the sound of our own breath. Hum on the inhale, Sa on the exhale. As long as we live, every time we breathe in or out, we are repeating this mantra. I am that. I am divine. I am with God. I am an expression of God. I am not separate. I am not alone. I am not this limited illusion of an individual. I've always found Hum Sa easy and relaxing, easier to meditate with than Om Namah Shivaya, the, how would you say this, official mantra of this yoga. But I was talking to this monk the other day, and he told me to go ahead and use Hum Sa if it helped my meditation. He said, "Meditate on whatever causes a revolution in your mind." So I'll sit here with it today. Ahamsa, I am that. Thoughts come, but I don't pay much attention to them, other than to say to them in an almost motherly manner, oh, I know you jokers. Go outside and play now. Mommy's listening to God. Hamsa, I am that. I fell asleep for a little while, or whatever. In meditation, you can never really be sure if what you think is sleep is actually sleep. Sometimes it's just another level of consciousness. When I awake, or whatever, I can feel this soft blue electrical energy pulsing through my body in waves. It's a little alarming, but also amazing. I don't know what to do, so I just speak internally to this energy. I say to it, I believe in you, and it magnifies, volumizes in response. It's frighteningly powerful now, like a kidnapping of the senses. It's humming up from the base of my spine. My neck feels like it wants to stretch and twist, so I let it, and then I'm sitting there in the strangest position, perched upright like a good yogi, but with my left ear pressed hard against my left shoulder. I don't know why my head and neck want to do this, but I'm not going to argue with them. They are insistent. The pounding blue energy keeps pitching through my body, and I can hear a sort of thrumming sound in my ears, and it's so mighty now that I actually can't deal with it anymore. It scares me so much that I say to it, I'm not ready yet, and I snap open my eyes. It all goes away. I'm back in a room again, back in my surroundings. I look at my watch. I've been here, or somewhere, for almost an hour. I am panting. Literally panting. 46. To understand what that experience was, what happened in there, by which I mean both in the meditation cave and in me, brings up a topic rather esoteric and wild, namely the subject of Kundalini Shakti. Every religion in the world has had a subset of devotees who seek a direct, transcendent experience with God, excusing themselves from fundamentalist scriptural or dogmatic study in order to personally encounter the divine. The interesting thing about these mystics is that when they describe their experiences, they all end up describing exactly the same occurrence. Generally, their union with God occurs in a meditative state and is delivered through an energy source that fills the entire body with euphoric electric light. The Japanese call this energy ki, the Chinese Buddhists call it qi, the Balinese call it Taksu, the Christians call it the Holy Spirit. The Kalahari Bushmen describe it as a snake-like power that ascends the spine and blows a hole in the head through which the gods then enter. The Islamic Sufi poets called that god energy the Beloved and wrote devotional poems to it. The Australian Aborigines describe a serpent in the sky that descends into the medicine man and gives him intense otherworldly powers. In the Jewish tradition of Kabbalah, this union with the divine is said to occur through stages of spiritual ascension, with energy that runs up the spine along a series of invisible meridians. Saint Teresa of Avila, that most mystical of Catholic figures, described her union with God as a physical ascension of light through seven inner mansions of her being, after which she burst into God's presence. She used to go into meditative trances so deep that the other nuns couldn't feel her pulse anymore. She would beg her fellow nuns not to tell anyone what they had witnessed, as it was a most extraordinary thing, and likely to arouse considerable talk, not to mention a possible interview with the Inquisitor. The most difficult challenge, the saint wrote in her memoirs, was to not stir up the intellect during meditation, for any thoughts of the mind, even the most fervent prayers, will extinguish the fire of God. Once the troublesome mind begins to compose speeches and dream up arguments, especially if these are clever, it will soon imagine it is doing important work. But if you can surpass these thoughts, Teresa explained, and ascend toward God, it is a glorious bewilderment, a heavenly madness in which true wisdom is acquired. Unknowingly echoing the poems of the Persian Sufi mystic Hafiz, who demanded why, with a God so wildly loving, are we not all screaming drunks, Teresa cried out in her autobiography that if these divine experiences were mere madness, then, I beseech you, Father, let us all be mad. Then, in the next sentences of her book, it's like she catches her breath. Reading Saint Teresa today, you can almost feel her coming out of that delirious experience and then looking around at the political climate of medieval Spain, where she lived under one of the most repressive religious tyrannies of history, and soberly, dutifully, apologizing for her excitement. She writes, "Forgive me if I have been very bold," and reiterates that all her idiot babbling should be ignored because, of course, she's just a woman and a worm and despicable vermin, etc., etc. You can almost see her smoothing back her nun's skirts and tucking away those last loose strands of hair, her divine secret, a blazing, hidden bonfire. In Indian yogic tradition, this divine secret is called Kundalini Shakti, and is depicted as a snake who lies coiled at the base of the spine until it is released by a master's touch or by a miracle, and which then ascends up through seven chakras, or wheels, which you might also call the seven mansions of the soul, and finally through the head, exploding into union with God. These chakras do not exist in the gross body, say the yogis, so don't look for them there. They exist only in the subtle body, in the body that the Buddhist teachers are referring to when they encourage their students to pull forth a new self from the physical body the way you pull a sword from its sheath. My friend Bob, who is both a student of yoga and a neuroscientist, told me that he was always agitated by this idea of the chakras, that he wanted to actually see them in a dissected human body in order to believe they existed. But after a particularly transcendent meditative experience, he came away with a new understanding of it. He said, "Just as there exists in writing a literal truth and a poetic truth, there also exists in a human being a literal anatomy and a poetic anatomy. One you can see, one you cannot. One is made of bones and teeth and flesh. The other is made of energy and memory and faith. But they are both equally true." I like it when science and devotion find places of intersection. I found an article in the New York Times recently about a team of neurologists who had wired up a volunteer Tibetan monk for experimental brain scanning. They wanted to see what happens to a transcendent mind, scientifically speaking, during moments of enlightenment. In the mind of a normal thinking person, an electrical storm of thoughts and impulses whirls constantly, registering on a brain scan as yellow and red flashes. The more angry or impassioned the subject becomes, the hotter and deeper those red flashes burn. But mystics across time and cultures have all described a stilling of the brain during meditation and say that the ultimate union with God is a blue light which they can feel radiating from the center of their skulls. In yogic tradition, this is called the blue pearl, and it is the goal of every seeker to find it. Sure enough, this Tibetan monk, monitored during meditation, was able to quiet his mind so completely that no red or yellow flashes could be seen. In fact, all the neurological energy of this gentleman pooled and collected at last into the center of his brain. You could see it happening right there on the monitor, into a small, cool, blue pearl of light, just like the yogis have always described. This is the destination of the Kundalini Shakti. In mystical India, as in many shamanistic traditions, Kundalini Shakti is considered a dangerous force to play around with if you are unsupervised. The inexperienced yogi could quite literally blow his mind with it. You need a teacher, a guru, to guide you on this path, and ideally a safe place, an ashram, from which to practice. It is said to be the guru's touch, either literally in person or through a more supernatural encounter like a dream, which releases the bound kundalini energy from its coil at the base of the spine and allows it to begin journeying upward toward God. This moment of release is called Shaktipat, divine initiation, and it is the greatest gift of an enlightened master. After that touch, the student might still labor for years toward enlightenment, but the journey has at least begun. The energy has been freed. I received Shaktipat initiation 2 years ago, when I met my guru for the first time back in New York. It was during a weekend retreat at her ashram in the Catskills. To be honest, I felt nothing special afterward. I was kind of hoping for a dazzling encounter with God, maybe some blue lightning or a prophetic vision. But I searched my body for special effects and only felt vaguely hungry, as usual. I remember thinking that I probably didn't have enough faith to ever experience anything really wild like unleashed Kundalini Shakti. I remember thinking that I was too brainy, not intuitive enough, and that my devotional path was probably going to be more intellectual than esoteric. I would pray, I would read books, I would think interesting thoughts, but I would probably never ascend into the kind of divine meditative bliss St. Teresa describes. But that was okay. I still loved devotional practice. It's just that Kundalini Shakti wasn't for me. The next day, though, something interesting did happen. We were all gathered with the guru once more. She led us into meditation, and in the middle of it all, I fell asleep, or whatever the state was, and had a dream. In this dream, I was on a beach at the ocean. The waves were massive and terrifying, and they were building fast. Suddenly, a man appeared beside me. It was my guru's own master, a great charismatic yogi I will refer to here only as Swamiji, which is Sanskrit for beloved monk. Swamiji had died in 1982. I knew him only from photographs around the ashram. Even through these photographs, I must admit, I'd always found the guy to be a little too scary, a little too powerful, a little too much on fire for my taste. I'd been dodging the idea of him for a long time, and generally avoiding his gaze as it stared down at me from the walls. He seemed overwhelming. He wasn't my kind of guru. I'd always preferred my lovely, compassionate, feminine living master to this deceased but still fierce character. But now Swamiji was in my dream, standing beside me on a beach in all his power. I was terrified. He pointed to the approaching waves and said sternly, "I want you to figure out a way to stop that from happening." Panicked, I whipped out a notebook and tried to draw inventions that would stop the ocean waves from advancing. I drew massive seawalls and canals and dams. All my designs were so stupid and pointless, though. I knew I was way out of my league here. I'm not an engineer. But I could feel Swamiji watching me, impatient and judgmental. Finally, I gave up. None of my inventions were clever or strong enough to keep those waves from breaking. That's when I heard Swamiji laugh. I looked up at this tiny Indian man in his orange robes, and he was veritably busting a gut in laughter, bent over double in delight, wiping mirthful tears from his eyes. "Tell me, dear one," he said, and he pointed out toward the colossal, powerful, endless, rocking ocean. "Tell me, if you would be so kind, how exactly were you planning on stopping that?" 47. Two nights in a row now, I've had dreams of a snake entering my room. I've read that this is spiritually auspicious, and not just in Eastern religions. Saint Ignatius had serpent visions all throughout his mystical experiences. But it doesn't make the snakes any less vivid or scary. I've been waking up sweating. Even worse, once I'm awake, my mind has been two-timing me again, betraying me into a state of panic like I haven't felt since the worst of the divorce years. My thoughts keep flying back to my failed marriage and to all the attendant shame and anger of that event. Worse, I'm again dwelling on David. I'm arguing with him in my mind. I'm mad and lonely and remembering every hurtful thing he ever said or did to me. Plus, I can't stop thinking about all our happiness together, the thrilling delirium when times were good. It's all I can do not to jump out of this bed and call him from India in the middle of the night and just, I don't know what, just hang up on him, probably, or beg him to love me again, or read him such a ferocious indictment on all his character flaws. Why is all this stuff coming up again now? I know what they would say, all the old-timers at this ashram. They would say that this is perfectly normal, that everyone goes through this, that intense meditation brings everything up, that you're just clearing out all your residual demons. But I'm in such an emotional state, I can't stand it, and I don't want to hear anyone's hippie theories. I recognize that everything is coming up, thank you very much, like vomit, it's coming up. Somehow, I managed to fall asleep again. Lucky me, and I have another dream. No snakes this time, but a rangy evil dog who chases me and says, "I will kill you. I will kill you and eat you." I wake up crying and shaking. I don't want to disturb my roommate, so I go hide in the bathroom. The bathroom. Always the bathroom. Heaven help me, but there I am in a bathroom again, in the middle of the night again, weeping my heart out on the floor in loneliness. Oh, cold world. I have grown so weary of you and all your horrible bathrooms. When the crying doesn't stop, I go get myself a notebook and a pen, last refuge of a scoundrel, and I sit once more beside the toilet. I open to a blank page and scrawl my now familiar plea of desperation. "I need your help." Then a long exhale of relief comes, as, in my own handwriting, my own constant friend, "Who is it?" commences loyally to my own rescue. "I'm right here. It's okay. I love you. I will never leave you. 48. The next morning's meditation is a disaster. Desperate, I beg my mind to please step aside and let me find God, but my mind stares at me with steely power and says, I will never let you pass me by. That whole next day, in fact, I'm so hateful and angry that I fear for the life of anyone who crosses my path. I snap at this poor German woman because she doesn't speak English well and she can't understand when I tell her where the bookstore is. I'm so ashamed of my rage that I go hide in yet another bathroom and cry, and then I'm so mad at myself for crying as I remember my guru's counsel not to fall apart all the time or else it becomes a habit. But what does she know about it? She's enlightened. She can't help me. She doesn't understand me. I don't want anyone to talk to me. I can't tolerate anyone's face right now. I even managed to dodge Richard from Texas for a while, but he eventually finds me at dinner and sits down, brave man, in my black smoke of self-loathing. What's got you all wadded up? He drawls, toothpick in his mouth as usual. Don't ask, I say. But then I start talking, and I tell him every bit of it, concluding with, and worst of all, I can't stop obsessing over David. I thought I was over him, but it's all coming up again. He says, give it another 6 months, you'll feel better. I've already given it 12 months, Richard. Then give it 6 more. Just keep throwing 6 months at it till it goes away. Stuff like this takes time. I exhale hotly through my nose, bull-like. Groceries, Richard says. Listen to me. Someday you're going to look back on this moment in your life as such a sweet time of grieving. You'll see that you were in mourning and your heart was broken, but your life was changing and you were in the best possible place in the world for it, in a beautiful place of worship surrounded by grace. Take this time, every minute of it. Let things work themselves out here in India. But I really loved him. Big deal, so you fell in love with someone. Don't you see what happened? This guy touched a place in your heart deeper than you thought you were capable of reaching. I mean, you got zapped, kiddo. But that love you felt, that was just the beginning. You just got a taste of love. That's just limited little rinky-dink mortal love. Wait till you see how much more deeply you can love than that. Heck, groceries. You have the capacity to someday love the whole world. It's your destiny. Don't laugh. I'm not laughing. I was actually crying. And please don't laugh at me now, but I think the reason it's so hard for me to get over this guy is because I seriously believed that David was my soulmate. He probably was. Your problem is you don't understand what that word means. People think a soulmate is your perfect fit, and that's what everyone wants. But a true soulmate is a mirror, the person who shows you everything that's holding you back, the person who brings you to your own attention so you can change your life. A true soulmate is probably the most important person you'll ever meet, because they tear down your walls and smack you awake. But to live with a soulmate forever? Nah, it's too painful. Soulmates, they come into your life just to reveal another layer of yourself to you, and then they leave, and thank God for it. Your problem is you just can't let this one go. It's over, groceries. David's purpose was to shake you up, drive you out of that marriage that you needed to leave, tear apart your ego a little bit, show you your obstacles and addictions, break your heart open so new light could get in, make you so desperate and out of control that you had to transform your life, then introduce you to your spiritual master and beat it. That was his job, and he did great. But now it's over. Problem is, you can't accept that this relationship had a real short shelf life. You're like a dog at the dump, baby. You're just licking at an empty tin can, trying to get more nutrition out of it. And if you're not careful, that can's going to get stuck on your snout forever and make your life miserable. So drop it. But I love him. So love him. But I miss him. So miss him. Send him love and light every time you think about him and then drop it. You're just afraid to let go of the last bits of David because then you'll really be alone. And Liz Gilbert is scared to death of what will happen if she's really alone. But here's what you got to understand, groceries. If you clear out all that space in your mind that you're using right now to obsess about this guy, you'll have a vacuum in there, an open spot, a doorway. And guess what the universe will do with that doorway? It'll rush in. God will rush in and fill you with more love than you ever dreamed. So stop using David to block that door. Let it go. But I wish me and David could... He cuts me off. See, now that's your problem. You're wishing too much, baby. You gotta stop wearing your wishbone where your backbone ought to be. This line gives me my first laugh of the day. Then I ask Richard, so how long will it be before all this grieving passes? You want an exact date? Yeah. Something you can circle on your calendar? Yeah. Let me tell you something, groceries. You got some serious control issues. My rage at this statement consumes me like fire. Control issues? Me? I actually consider slapping Richard for this insult. And then, from right down inside the intensity of my offended outrage, comes the truth. The immediate, obvious, laughable truth. He's totally right. The fire passes out of me fast as it came. You're totally right, I say. I know I'm right, baby. Listen, you're a powerful woman, and you're used to getting what you want out of life, and you didn't get what you wanted in your last few relationships. It's got you all jammed up. Your husband didn't behave the way you want him to, and David didn't either. Life didn't go your way for once, and nothing pisses off a control freak more than life not going her way. Don't call me a control freak, please. You have got control issues, groceries. Come on. Nobody ever told you this before? Well, yeah. But the thing about divorcing someone is that you kind of stop listening to all the mean stuff they say about you after a while. So I buck up and admit it. Okay, I think you're probably right. Maybe I do have a problem with control. It's just weird that you noticed, because I don't think it's that obvious on the surface. I mean, I bet most people can't see my control issues when they first look at me. Richard from Texas laughs so hard he almost loses his toothpick. They can't? Honey, Ray Charles could see your control issues. Okay, I think I'm done with this conversation now. Thank you. You gotta learn how to let go, groceries. Otherwise, you're gonna make yourself sick. Never gonna have a good night's sleep again. You'll just toss and turn forever, beaten up on yourself for being such a fiasco in life. What's wrong with me? How come I screw up all my relationships? Why am I such a failure? Let me guess. That's probably what you were up all hours doing to yourself again last night. All right, Richard, that's enough, I say. I don't want you walking around inside my head anymore. Shut the door, then, says my big Texas yogi. 49. When I was 9 years old, going on 10, I experienced a true metaphysical crisis. Maybe this seems young for such a thing, but I was always a precocious child. It all happened over the summer between 4th and 5th grade. I was going to be turning 10 years old in July, and there was something about the transition from 9 to 10, from single digit to double digits, that shocked me into a genuine existential panic, usually reserved for people turning 50. I remember thinking that life was passing me by so fast. It seemed like only yesterday I was in kindergarten, and here I was, about to turn 10. Soon I would be a teenager, then middle-aged, then elderly, then dead, and everyone else was aging in hyperspeed too. Everybody else was going to be dead soon. My parents would die, my friends would die, my cat would die. My older sister was almost in high school already. I could remember her going off to 1st grade only moments ago, it seemed, in her little knee socks. And now she was in high school? Obviously, it wouldn't be long before she was dead. What was the point of all this? The strangest thing about this crisis was that nothing in particular had spurred it. No friend or relative had died, giving me my first taste of mortality, nor had I read or seen anything particular about death. I hadn't even read Charlotte's Web yet. This panic I was feeling at age 10 was nothing less than a spontaneous and full-out realization of mortality's inevitable march, and I had no spiritual vocabulary with which to help myself manage it. We were Protestants, and not even devout ones at that. We said grace only before Christmas and Thanksgiving dinner, and went to church sporadically. My dad chose to stay home Sunday mornings, finding his devotional practice in farming. I sang in the choir because I liked singing. My pretty sister was the angel in the Christmas pageant. My mother used the church as a headquarters from which to organize good works of volunteer service for the community. But even in that church, I don't remember there being a lot of talking about God. This was New England, after all, and the word God tends to make Yankees nervous. My sense of helplessness was overwhelming. What I wanted to do was pull some massive emergency brake on the universe, like the brakes I'd seen on the subways during our school trip to New York City. I wanted to call a timeout, to demand that everybody just stop until I could understand everything. I suppose this urge to force the entire universe to stop in its tracks until I could get a grip on myself might have been the beginning of what my dear friend Richard from Texas calls my control issues. Of course, my efforts and worry were futile. The closer I watched time, the faster it spun. And that summer went by so quickly that it made my head hurt. And at the end of every day, I remember thinking, another one gone, and bursting into tears. I have a friend from high school who now works with the mentally handicapped, and he says his autistic patients have a particularly heartbreaking awareness of time's passage, as if they never got the mental filter that allows the rest of us to forget about mortality every once in a while and just live. One of Rob's patients always asks him the date at the beginning of every day, and at the end of every day will ask, "Rob, when will it be February 4th again?" And before Rob can answer, the guy shakes his head in sorrow and says, I know, never mind, not until next year, right? I know this feeling all too intimately. I know the sad longing to delay the end of another February 4th. This sadness is one of the great trials of the human experiment. As far as we know, we are the only species on the planet who have been given the gift, or curse perhaps, of awareness about our own mortality. Everything here eventually dies. We're just the lucky ones who get to think about this fact every day. How are you going to cope with this information? When I was 9, I couldn't do a thing with it except to cry. Later, over the years, my hypersensitive awareness of time's speed led me to push myself to experience life at a maximum pace. If I were going to have such a short visit on Earth, I had to do everything possible to experience it now. Hence, all the traveling, all the romances, all the ambition, all the pasta. My sister had a friend who used to think that Catherine had 2 or 3 younger sisters, because she was always hearing stories about the sister who was in Africa, the sister who was working on a ranch in Wyoming, the sister who was the bartender in New York, the sister who was writing a book, the sister who was getting married. Surely this could not all be the same person. Indeed, if I could have split myself into many Liz Gilberts, I would willingly have done so in order to not miss a moment of life. What am I saying? I did split myself into many Liz Gilberts, all of whom simultaneously collapsed in exhaustion on a bathroom floor in the suburbs one night, somewhere around the age of 30. I should say here that I'm aware not everyone goes through this kind of metaphysical crisis. Some of us are hardwired for anxiety about mortality, while some of us just seem more comfortable with the whole deal. You meet lots of apathetic people in this world, of course, but you also meet some people who seem to be able to gracefully accept the terms upon which the universe operates and who genuinely don't seem troubled by its paradoxes and injustices. I have a friend whose grandmother used to tell her, "There's no trouble in this world so serious that it can't be cured with a hot bath, a glass of whiskey, and the Book of Common Prayer." For some people, that's truly enough. For others, more drastic measures are required. And now I will mention my friend, the dairy farmer from Ireland. On the surface, a most unlikely character to me in an Indian ashram. But Sean is one of those people like me who were born with the itch, the mad and relentless urge to understand the workings of existence. His little parish in County Cork didn't seem to have any of these answers, so he left the farm in the 1980s to go traveling through India looking for inner peace through yoga. A few years later, he returned home to the dairy farm in Ireland. He was sitting in the kitchen of the old stone house with his father, a lifelong farmer and a man of few words, and Sean was telling him all about his spiritual discoveries in the exotic East. Sean's father listened with mild interest, watching the fire in the hearth, smoking his pipe. He didn't speak at all until Sean said, "Da, this meditation stuff, it's crucial for teaching serenity. It can really save your life. It teaches you how to quiet your mind." His father turned to him and said kindly, "I have a quiet mind already, son," then resumed his gaze on the fire. But I don't, nor does Sean. Many of us don't. Many of us look into the fire and see only inferno. I need to actively learn how to do what Sean's father, it seems, was born knowing, how to, as Walt Whitman once wrote, stand apart from the pulling and hauling, amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary, both in and out of the game, and watching, and wondering at it all. Instead of being amused, though, I'm only anxious. Instead of watching, I'm always probing and interfering. The other day in prayer, I said to God, "Look, I understand that an unexamined life is not worth living, but do you think I could someday have an unexamined lunch?" Buddhist lore has a story about the moments that followed the Buddha's transcendence into enlightenment, when, after 39 days in meditation, the veil of illusion finally fell away and the true workings of the universe were revealed to the great master, he is reported to have opened his eyes and said immediately, "This cannot be taught." But then he changed his mind, decided that he would go out into the world after all and attempt to teach the practice of meditation to a small handful of students. He knew there would only be a meager percentage of people who would be served by or interested in his teachings. Most of humanity, he said, have eyes that are so caked shut with the dust of deception that they will never see the truth, no matter who tries to help them. A few others, like Shans Da, perhaps, are so naturally clear-eyed and calm already that they need no instruction or assistance whatsoever. But then there are those whose eyes are just slightly caked with dust, and who might, with the help of the right master, be taught to see more clearly someday. The Buddha decided he would become a teacher for the benefit of that minority, for those of little dust. I dearly hope that I am one of those mid-level dust-caked people, but I don't know. I only know that I have been driven to find inner peace with methods that might seem a bit drastic for the general populace. For instance, when I told one friend back in New York City that I was going to India to live in an ashram and search for divinity, he sighed and said, "Oh, there's a part of me that so wishes I wanted to do that, but I really have no desire for it whatsoever." I don't know that I have much of a choice, though. I have searched frantically for contentment for so many years in so many ways, and all these acquisitions and accomplishments, they run you down in the end. Life, if you keep chasing it so hard, will drive you to death. Time, when pursued like a bandit, will behave like one, always remaining one county or one room ahead of you, changing its name and hair color to elude you, slipping out the back door of the motel just as you're banging through the lobby with your newest search warrant, leaving only a burning cigarette in the ashtray to taunt you. At some point, you have to stop because it won't. You have to admit that you can't catch it, that you're not supposed to catch it. At some point, as Richard keeps telling me, you gotta let go and sit still and allow contentment to come to you. Letting go, of course, is a scary enterprise for those of us who believe that the world revolves only because it has a handle on the top of it, which we personally turn, and that if we were to drop this handle for even a moment, well, that would be the end of the universe. But try dropping it, groceries. This is the message I'm getting. Sit quietly for now and cease your relentless participation. Watch what happens. The birds do not crash dead out of the sky in mid-flight after all. The trees do not wither and die. The rivers do not run red with blood. Life continues to go on. Even the Italian post office will keep limping along, doing its own thing without you. Why are you so sure that your micromanagement of every moment in this whole world is so essential? Why don't you let it be? I hear this argument, and it appeals to me. I believe in it intellectually. I really do. But then I wonder, with all my restless yearning, with all my hyped-up fervor, and with this stupidly hungry nature of mine, what should I do with my energy instead? That answer arrives, too. Look for God, suggests my guru. Look for God like a man with his head on fire looks for water. 50. The next morning in meditation, all my caustic old hateful thoughts come up again. I'm starting to think of them as irritating telemarketers, always calling at the most inopportune moments. What I'm alarmed to find in meditation is that my mind is actually not that interesting a place, after all. In actuality, I really only think about a few things, and I think about them constantly. I believe the official term is brooding. I brood about my divorce, and all the pain of my marriage, and all the mistakes I made, and all the mistakes my husband made, and then, and there's no return from this dark topic, I start brooding about David. Which is getting embarrassing, to be quite honest. I mean, here I am in this sacred place of study in the middle of India, and all I can think about is my ex-boyfriend. What am I, in eighth grade? And then I remember a story my friend Deborah, the psychologist, told me once. Back in the 1980s, she was asked by the city of Philadelphia if she could volunteer to offer psychological counseling to a group of Cambodian refugees, boat people, who had recently arrived in the city. Deborah is an exceptional psychologist, but she was terribly daunted by this task. These Cambodians had suffered the worst of what humans can inflict on each other, genocide, rape, torture, starvation, the murder of their relatives before their eyes, then long years in refugee camps and dangerous boat trips to the West, where people died and corpses were fed to sharks. What could Deborah offer these people in terms of help? How could she possibly relate to their suffering? But don't you know, Deborah reported to me, what all these people wanted to talk about once they could see a counselor? It was all, I met this guy when I was living in the refugee camp and we fell in love. I thought he really loved me, but then we were separated on different boats and he took up with my cousin. Now he's married to her, but he says he really loves me and he keeps calling me and I know I should tell him to go away, but I still love him and I can't stop thinking about him and I don't know what to do. This is what we are like. Collectively, as a species, this is our emotional landscape. I met an old lady once, almost 100 years old, and she told me there are only two questions that human beings have ever fought over all through history. How much do you love me, and who's in charge? Everything else is somehow manageable. But these two questions of love and control undo us all, trip us up and cause war, grief, and suffering. And both of them, unfortunately, or maybe obviously, are what I'm dealing with at this ashram. When I sit in silence and look at my mind, it is only questions of longing and control that emerge to agitate me, and this agitation is what keeps me from evolving forward. When I tried this morning, after an hour or so of unhappy thinking, to dip back into my meditation, I took a new idea with me. Compassion. I asked my heart if it could please infuse my soul with a more generous perspective on my mind's workings. Instead of thinking that I was a failure, could I perhaps accept that I am only a human being, and a normal one at that? The thoughts came up as usual, okay, so it will be, and then the attendant emotions rose too. I began feeling frustrated and judgmental about myself, lonely and angry. But then a fierce response boiled up from somewhere in the deepest caverns of my heart, and I told myself, I will not judge you for these thoughts. My mind tried to protest, said, yeah, but you're such a failure, you're such a loser, you'll never amount to anything. But suddenly, it was like a lion was roaring from within my chest, drowning all this claptrap out. A voice bellowed at me like nothing I had ever heard before. It was so internally, eternally loud that I actually clapped my hand over my mouth because I was afraid that if I opened my mouth and let this sound out, it would shake the foundations of buildings as far away as Detroit. And this is what it roared. You have no idea how strong my love is. The chattering, negative thoughts in my mind scattered in the wind of this statement like birds and jackrabbits and antelopes. They high-tailed it out of there, terrified. Silence followed, an intense, vibrating, awed silence. The lion in the giant savanna of my heart surveyed his newly quiet kingdom with satisfaction. He licked his great chops once, closed his yellow eyes, and went back to sleep. And then, in that regal silence, finally, I began to meditate on, and with, God. 51. Richard from Texas has some cute habits. Whenever he passes me in the ashram and notices by my distracted face that my thoughts are a million miles away, he says, "How's David doing?" "Mind your own business," I always say. "You don't know what I'm thinking about, mister." Of course, he's always right. Another habit he has is to wait for me when I come out of the meditation hall because he likes to see how wigged out and spazzy I look when I crawl out of there, like I've been wrestling alligators and ghosts. He says he's never watched anybody fight so hard against herself. I don't know about that, but it's true that what goes on in that dark meditation room for me can get pretty intense. The most fierce experiences come when I let go of some last fearful reserve and permit a veritable turbine of energy to unleash itself up my spine. It amuses me now that I ever dismissed these ideas of the Kundalini Shakti as mere myth. When this energy rides through me, it rumbles like a diesel engine in low gear, and all it asks of me is this one simple request. Will you kindly turn yourself inside out so that your lungs and heart and offal will be on the outside and the whole universe will be on the inside? And emotionally, will you do the same? Time gets all screwy in this thunderous space, and I am taken, numbed, dumbed, and stunned, to all sorts of worlds, and I experience every intensity of sensation, fire, cold, hatred, lust, fear. When it's all over, I wobble to my feet and stagger out into the daylight in such a state, ravenously hungry, desperately thirsty,